KALW.
Mohammed Nuru was being watched very, very closely. And so were all the people who are as yet unnamed in this case. And it's a vast sea of casual corruption.
As a corruption scandal rocks San Francisco's Department of Public Works, today its head, Mohammed Nuru, resigned.
They weren't trying to take over the world. They weren't influencing elections. They weren't running diamonds out of South Africa. They were trying to get a chicken restaurant into the airport.
We'll get the latest on the Nuru case. Then we debut a series made by, about, and for high schoolers.
My teammates and I have been called out for wearing pants instead of skirts. We've been called out for being too aggressive. And we've been called demeaning names like sweetheart or bitch by male debaters and judges.
I'm Hena Baba, and this is Cross Currents. San Francisco Public Works Director Mohammed Nuru resigned today. Nuru is embroiled in a scandal charged with fraud and corruption. A 75-page federal complaint alleges that Nuru betrayed San Francisco by engaging in bribery and side deals. One of the first news outlets to cover the Nuru scandal closely from the beginning is Mission Local, which published an article about the ordeal in late January. And many things are involved, including a permit for a building on Fulton Street, a bribe to allow a chicken shop at SFO, and a tractor. We're beginning to understand the extent of the alleged corruption thanks in large part to the investigative work of my guest, Joe Eskenazi. He's managing editor of Mission Local, and we brought him in to connect the dots. All right, so let's get into these charges. What exactly are they?
The feds charge federal crimes, and I know that sounds a bit redundant, but wire fraud, which is one of those nebulous things, is the charge here. And in this case, the charges stem out of a single case where they allegedly tried to bribe an airport commissioner $5,000 to get this chicken shack into SFO. There are four other quote-unquote schemes, and these are not being charged, but my understanding is that you only need a preponderance of evidence to bring them in as behavioral motive type things. Mm-hmm. Here's what kind of guy he is. And these involve allegedly taking riches and booze and accommodations from a Chinese billionaire in order to allegedly help that billionaire's project on 555 Fulton Street.
And stone? What's that?
I don't think it's Mick Jagger. I think it might be precious stones.
Mm-hmm.
Some stone was what Nuru allegedly said on the wiretap. And also boasted about a $10,000 bottle of liquor that they shared, and he was allegedly gifted a $2,000 bottle of wine.
And then as you were digging into this, and it was, you know, what really caught your eye and made you want to dig into this further?
Well, it's the casual corruption. Certainly everyone's innocent until proven guilty, but there's a preponderance of evidence caught on wiretaps here. There's a preponderance of evidence that was monitored, bank accounts, transfers, and things of that sort. Mohammed Nuru was being watched very, very closely, and so were all the people who are as yet unnamed in this case, and it's a vast sea of casual corruption. And again, they weren't trying to take over the world. They weren't influencing elections. They weren't running diamonds out of South Africa. They were trying to get a chicken restaurant into the airport. They were having free or cheap work done by city contractors on Nuru's country home. Billionaire allegedly influencing him to try and get favors done on an actually long-stalled project at 555 Fulton. Things of that sort.
So casual corruption, but do you suspect there's more, or do you think that this is it?
So the answer to your question is twofold. Do I suspect there's more? Absolutely. The purpose of this long-running, years-long investigation was not to catch Mohammed Nuru allegedly being given a tractor. If you look at the chronology of it all of the alleged offenses took place in 2018 and then early 2019, and he wasn't arrested by the FBI until January 21st, 2020. Hmm. So obviously they were doing something. And they brought him in and said, here's what we got, and we want you to work with us. He did not work with them. Allegedly, he told people about what was going on, which was expressly what he promised not to do. Therefore, he must have...
He pissed them off.
He did, and he quite possibly muddied up the investigation, and he quite possibly put himself on top of the grenade there, intentionally or not, to save the real targets of the investigation, who are somewhat higher up than a public works director of a mid-sized American city.
Hmm. And you know... you and Mission Local have been looking at corruption in San Francisco for a long time. Is this kind of fitting in the pattern of previous investigations and previous corruption investigations in the city, do you think? Or is this something totally different and new to you?
It's not different and new. It does fit in some ways. The clearest analog is Leland Yee and Shrimp Boy and others being caught in federal wiretaps and many of them, you know, going down in 2014. Mm. What's different here is how central Mohamed Nuru is to everybody. He made himself indispensable. He's the guy you called up to clean up a mess, and he'd clean it up if he liked you, and if he didn't, well, we don't know. And also, as I've said elsewhere, as I've written elsewhere, his lengthy resume of ethical missteps while in, you know, some manner of meritocracy might have kept him from ever attaining the position he had, in truth, was his resume. He was given this job because he was a person who had these ethics and would do what he was asked. And if you were going to ask someone to do something they shouldn't do and you wanted them to do it, he was the guy. So that he was someone who would do what was asked was known. That he was someone who was that it's now beyond the question that they were taking a rough hand to the city's homeless and pushing them out of sight, because that was the goal. I don't want to see these people, as opposed to what can we do to help. You could say that in San Francisco, and people often bemoan our results with our budget, but to take this approach to homeless people, to kind of outsource homeless policy to the people whose job it is to clean up the street, is a problem. And that was happening. And we knew that before, and now we have it in written proof. And you know, you'd have to be a denier of some sort to say it's not happening.
Why did he stay in the position if it was so well known?
Because he was a convenient person. Because
to whom?
To the people in power, to five mayors. Five mayors kept him in this position because he got things done.
All right. So now Nuru is out. What do you think is going to happen next in terms of public works?
They have a new fella in there, a fella that doesn't come with Mohamed Nuru's pedigree of being a kneecapper for the former powers that be. It's a guy who's apparently an expert in ethical contracting. And, you know, there are a great many...
An expert in ethical contracting.
Yeah. And
that's on purpose.
Well, I imagine that made him suddenly, you know, like they need to get them some of that reform. Yeah. And it's good to have a competent person who is, you know, respected for ethics in a job like this. Now, what we can do if we wish, and I take the burden for this as well, is why did we wait until now to say things that everybody knew? You know, there are a number of city politicians who are righteously and, you know, complaining about the way things were. And that's their prerogative. And it's not wrong. It's good. But on the other hand, you know, people knew about this. They did not know about the particulars of the chicken shack or the tractor. But people knew about what was going on with them going ahead of time to clean off the mayor's itinerary spots, with allegations of casual corruption, with favored treatment as to what gets clean and what doesn't, all that kind of stuff. And the city can be as clean as it wants to be, metaphorically and otherwise.
Joe Eskenazi is managing editor of Mission Local. We've got a link to his latest articles at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, we're debuting a new series made by, about, and for high schoolers and anybody else who wants to hear what's on their minds. It's hosted by Oakland's youth poet laureate Samuel Getacho. He'll take it from here.
This is TBH. I'm Samuel Getacho. This podcast is made by, about, and for teenagers, and for anybody else who wants to hear what's on our minds. Thoughts are power. Words are power. James Baldwin said that the root function of language is to control the universe by describing it. And this holds especially true at a time when fake news and inflammatory rhetoric spewed by politicians has such control over our national narrative. It's crucial for us to pay attention to the stories we consume, the voices we listen to, and the language we allow to describe and thus control our universe. Today, we're going to talk about discrimination, specifically when it comes to speech and voice. As part of this podcast, we spoke with over 100 San Francisco high school students, and we asked them to share stories about how they influence and are influenced by the media. We edited their thoughts and brought them together thematically, so let's listen to a few right now.
My name is Lucas Dong, and I'm an 11th grader at Lincoln High School. When I was younger, I didn't value the news very much. The cartoons on TV were much more important to me than some old man blabbering about current events. As my mom drove me to school, she would turn on the radio to listen to the public radio, and I would never pay attention, staring out the window or finding something else to distract me. When they turned on the evening news every night, they tried to get me involved and interested, though I ignored them. A few years ago, however, things started to change. I understood more of what the headlines were about, and I connected the local events to my life. I remember learning about the diversity and content that the news could have. I went from hearing about shocking events like the Sandy Hook shooting to reading articles that aligned more with my personal interests. I came to appreciate the news and how it keeps me updated, and I still appreciate it to this day.
My name is Marco. I am a sophomore at Galileo Academy. Ever since I was very young, I liked watching American TV shows and movies. But one thing that's bothering me at the time was there was not enough Chinese actors. And when there was, I was very excited because I get to almost see myself in TV and movies. I would like to see more Chinese actors used in a positive way instead of a negative way.
So my name is Maribo Bipsa. I'm in 10th grade and I attend Galileo High School. Over the years of my life, since I was a child, I've realized there aren't any hijabi women on American TV or movies. There would usually be Arab people and they would be portrayed in a bad way. Usually it would be a racist implication towards the person. We have a hijabi congresswoman in office and we still can't promote hijabi women on TV. There needs to be more hijabi women on American TV and movies so many hijabi women around the world could feel empowered.
Like all other systems of oppression, sexism presents itself in almost every facet of our lives. For example, this year is an election year, and when it comes to running for office, women are subject to certain kinds of disrespect that men are not. And as we saw demonstrated all too well in 2016, male politicians often reinforce and exacerbate these double standards. And these double standards are far from exclusive to presidential races. They're part of a pattern that begins as early as high school. We're going to hear about that from Hannah Nee. She's a high school senior in San Jose.
During the 2016 election, my friends and I were super excited. Hillary Clinton was the first woman to have a real shot at winning the U.S. presidency. We could finally have someone who looked like us in the most powerful position in the country. But as I watched how some media outlets covered the presidential race, I noticed Hillary Clinton was treated much differently than our male opponents. Pundits like Bob Woodward criticized the way she dressed and spoke on Morning Joe.
She shouts. There is something unrelaxed about the way she is communicating.
During a town hall event, former New Jersey mayor and presidential candidate Chris Christie made a derogatory and disgusting remark about Clinton.
I'll beat her rear end on that stage, and you know what? After I do, she'll be relieved because she'll just be worried I was going to serve her with a subpoena.
The way Clinton was treated felt all too familiar to me because I'm on a debate team at an all-girls school. In this clip, I'm debating at a tournament about whether antitrust regulations should be enforced on big tech.
That the only reason investors invest is because there is a potential lucrative buyout from big tech at the end of the day. That's important because...
My teammates and I have been called out for wearing pants instead of skirts. We've been called out for being too aggressive. And we've been called demeaning names like sweetheart or bitch by male debaters and judges. When I joined debate freshman year, I didn't know this stuff was going to happen. I just knew that I wanted to debate. Because where else was a high schooler going to find a space to talk about universal background checks or market rate housing? Where else was a teenage girl allowed to voice her thoughts for an uninterrupted 45 minutes and finally be heard? I thought debate was going to be the most empowering and intellectually stimulating experience. But I soon discovered debate could also be used to embarrass other people and make them feel inferior and insignificant.
So you're really misconstruing our evidence.
That's
here.
Literally what you say, word for word. Okay, anything with 10% support. Yeah, no,
it's okay, it's 10% committed support, and it's specifically...
I remember watching two high schoolers debate Catalonian independence from Spain at Arizona State University last year. I was shocked by the level of disrespect I saw. The guy constantly interrupted the female debater, and it was very obvious she was frustrated.
If you want to call for the card instead of just making fun of me in Crossfire, please do that.
I'm making fun of you because you ran a ridiculous argument. You can take a question.
No, I'm actually going to address this first.
Okay, do it.
If you'll let me. So what the card says is they designed...
He ended up winning the round. I don't know if the judges noticed his behavior, but they voted unanimously for his team. But it doesnn't end there.
Lobbies against gun control, no matter whether you affirm or negate.
Megan Muntz was one of my teammates on the debate team a year ago. Here she is giving a speech about gun control.
Says the only reason the NRA has power is because they're able to mobilize voters to get out for senators that they lobby. However,
over the years, she has been objectified repeatedly by members of the debate community. When she was 16, she was at a local tournament when she ran into two accomplished male debaters. Later, she learned they had called her a temptress and joked about what it would be like to have sex with her, even though they had literally met for a few minutes.
There were so many instances like that where people made disgusting comments about me, and it left me feeling like they don't care about me because I'm somewhat of a good debater. They only care about me for what I look like.
And after a while, all the sexism and misogyny took a mental toll on her. And she often thought about quitting.
Because it was kind of like at the age of 16, my body wasn't my own anymore. It belonged to the people who were looking at me and making those sorts of comments about me.
Treatment by competitors is one issue. Judging is another. Unlike other activities where you can just count the number of baskets you make, you win debate rounds if your judge has a better perception of you than your opponents. So, if judges think your voice sounds screechy or your dress doesn't fit their taste, they can mark you down, even if your arguments are stronger. According to one study, female debaters are twice as likely to be called out for aggression. And if this happens, they're much more likely to lose. This issue of being judged unfairly is true for female debaters and women in general. Jade Newton Small is the author of Broad Influence: How Women Are Changing the Way America Works. She says we're not a country used to seeing women in power, and that media coverage during the 2016 election was a clear example of that.
You know, Bernie Sanders can yell at you for 40 minutes, and you're like, yeah, yell at me for 40 more.
What about the Wall Street bailout, where some of your friends destroyed this economy?
You know...
excuse me, I'm talking.
Let him sprung.
Hillary raises her voice and yells at you, and you're like, oh my God, why is mom screaming at me?
Very hopeful. Inclusive, big-hearted America that will set the stage for an even better future.
Now we're in another election cycle, and more women than ever before are running for president. Senator Elizabeth Warren stood her ground at the recent Democratic debate.
You know, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
When I saw Warren debate, I was in awe of how assertive she was about her policies and beliefs. And I was happily surprised to find out that she was once a high school debater like me. And since she's had more media coverage, my coaches have started to tell me to channel my inner Elizabeth Warren. It's been really awesome seeing someone who was once in my position trying to be the leader of our country. Newton Small says high school debate is the perfect breeding ground for teenagers like me to learn how to speak up about important issues for the rest of our lives.
I mean, feeling comfortable speaking publicly is the first step to running for office in many ways. And I think just in general, the first step to being a leader.
If my friends and I don't feel comfortable speaking in a debate round because of discriminatory backlash, how can we feel comfortable speaking up when we're older and try to break barriers? But now, more people in debate are at least talking about this. Like at the National Speech and Debate Tournament in Dallas this year, a high schooler named Ella Snocky gave a speech on sexism in debate.
Either conform to societal expectations of submission and lose credibility, or demonstrate intensity and be labeled too aggressive. This unwinnable bias is so deeply ingrained in our culture that we have often become blind to its consequences. I love speech and debate, and this activity thrives on calling out oppressions all over the world. But it's time to call out the ones in our own community.
At the end of the speech, she talks about how important it is for people in debate to bring up double standards. As an analogy, she talks about a female drummer who keeps on drumming in spite of sexist expectations.
So, the Drum Dream girl closed her eyes and kept on drumming.
The room was silent. And then everyone stood up and started clapping, including me. She won first place. There are thousands of girls involved in speech and debate around the country. Despite the challenges we face, we won't stop speaking up and working hard. My friends and I will continue to research foreign affairs and social injustices. We'll put together arguments and practice our speeches and wait for our next debate round to begin.
That story was reported by Hannah Nee. She's a senior at Presentation High School in San Jose. While I haven't participated in debate, I have competed in mock trial for the past 3 years. And as a cisgender male student, I haven't ever been forced to think about how gender impacts the way I'm treated or listened to, in competition or otherwise. And as someone who lives at the intersection of multiple marginalized identities, being Black and first generation, to name a few, it can be easy to forget the ways in which my voice is inherently privileged. As a storyteller, I can't overemphasize the importance of voice and of speech. I'm too much of a cynic to say that the world would be a better place with more stories. But even at my most cynical, I can't deny that the world would be a more empathetic and informed one. There's not a lack of stories to tell or voices to listen to. Rather, we create an artificial void when we make it more difficult for certain voices to be heard. Thanks to students like Hannah and her friends, we are filling that void, one speech at a time. In the next episode, we'll take on the topic of social consciousness and the difference between activism and slacktivism.
Being woke is a process. I think people use it as like an adjective to describe like you've reached enlightenment, like you understand systematic racism.
Talk to you next time on TBH. Thanks for listening. I'm Samuel Getacho.
That was the first episode in our new podcast, TBH. TBH team producers were trained and edited by Holly J. McDeed and Kristen McCandless. Episodes drop every week on Monday. Subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Now let's wrap it up with some local music. This is Sugar Candy Mountain from San Francisco. They're performing at the Rickshaw Stop. It's Friday night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sona Avakian, Janae Darden, Christopher Agusa, True Gwynn, and Marissa Ortega-Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trafney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony, who also made the theme music for TBH. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.